During this stay, I was in contact with the information agency run by Osama bin Laden. I went to the agency, and a man gave me a video cassette and two CDs. Watching a video cassette, I saw images showing the pains suffered by Muslims in various parts of the world. They were images from Bosnia, Chechnya, Palestine, and also Indonesia. In particular, I saw a Christian who had taken out the heart of a Muslim and had eaten it. Also, there was a woman who was raped by seven men. My wife watched the video cassette many times. She said that she saw a sequence where a little baby of 4 months in Palestine was killed. She was shot in her abdomen while she was in her mother's arms on a bus. At the end of this week, I came back to Jalalabad. I watched the video cassette I brought from Kandahar many times. I was deeply struck by these images, and I was convinced to increase my commitment towards the Afghan people I loved. Their poverty was for me comparable to the poverty of the people I watched in the video cassette. My troubles in Jalalabad continued. There were two people who gave me troubles. One of these men was much too interested in my financial means. His questions bothered me, and then I decided to go back to Osama bin Laden in Kandahar. This happened a week or two after my return to Jalalabad. I met again with Osama bin Laden, and I asked him if I could do something for Islam. He told me that I didn't have to worry. He tried to brighten up the atmosphere. While I was in Kandahar, a discussion was underway about the possibility of destroying the Buddhist statues in Bamyan. The two statues of the Buddha, hundreds of feet high, were carved from cliffs in the 3rd and 5th centuries AD. They were once one of Afghanistan's most famous tourist attractions. The Taliban would destroy the Buddhas with artillery and explosives in May 2001. A day or so after my arrival in Kandahar, Osama bin Laden suggested to me to accompany him to Bamyan in central Afghanistan. We went there by helicopter. We stayed there a half day. We climbed the mountain, and we participated in wrecking one of the statues, hitting it with our feet on its head. I remember that the Taliban explosives hadn't completely destroyed the statue, and the Taliban launched a missile at the statue, making a hole in Buddha's head. When I got back home, I resumed my activity, and I watched the video cassette of atrocities against Muslims brought from Kandahar. After watching the video cassette, I lost control of my emotions, and I came back to Osama bin Laden in Kandahar. I stayed in a villa where bin Laden was. Afterward, I left for a training camp close to the neighborhood of Kandahar Airport. When I arrived, a rally against the Americans was underway. During the rally, a video where Osama bin Laden and Ayman Zawahiri shook hands was recorded. Bin Laden announced that what happened to the USS Cole is nothing compared to what the Americans are in for next. During the rally in July 2001, an alliance between Ayman Zawahiri and Osama bin Laden was made against the Americans and the Jews. Before this alliance, bin Laden and Zawahiri formed two separate groups. After the rally, I came back to Kandahar, where I stayed, and I talked to Abu Hafs, al-Qaeda's military commander. I explained him my feelings after watching the video cassette, and I spoke of my resentment towards the Americans. I expressed my wish to talk to Osama bin Laden, but he replied that I had to make a clear speech towards him. Then I said to Abu Hafs that I was ready to commit an attack. This meant for me a suicide attack, the offer of my life. As I was in a bad mood and I wanted to act in the fastest possible way, I didn't wait for Abu Hafs' answer, and I went directly to bin Laden. I explained to bin Laden what I said to Abu Hafs, and he expressed his reservations about my project. He suggested that I should wait because the list of people wanting to be martyrs was full. The following day, I talked again to bin Laden, and I insisted a lot with him. He gave me his authorization to talk directly to Abu Hafs. In a certain way, he was giving Abu Hafs an order. This meant that bin Laden had accepted that my name was to be added to the martyrs' list for the next attacks. Afterward, I talked to Abu Hafs, who told me that it was all right and I had only to wait. In the meantime, someone informed me that my wife had problems. As she was pregnant, I decided to allow her to go back to Europe. I sold our house, and my wife went back to Europe. I spent 3 or 4 weeks in that villa in Kandahar, where I was trained in the use of explosives. A certain number of targets were suggested to me, including what later became my target, an American base in Belgium. It was a NATO base in Kleine Brochel. The attack should have been carried out by 3 people beyond me. 2 of them, a Saudi and a Yemeni, were in the same villa in Kandahar with me. My assignment was to carry out the attack and to buy the ingredients to make the bomb. I was given a list of chemical products to buy, and I learned their names by heart. I took the Swissair flight Karachi to Zurich. Then I took a train to Brussels. 1 or 2 weeks after my arrival in Brussels, I called a Saudi who was in Holland to check if the Saudi and the Yemeni guys who were trained with me had arrived. Yes was the answer. I bought acetone, sulfur, and nitrate. I tried also to buy hydrazine without success. The hydrazine was later provided by the Saudi guy living in Holland. I surveyed the area of the attack to become familiar with it. The chosen place for the attack, Kleine Brochel, the NATO base, was suggested by the Saudi guy. No date was indicated for the attack. We only had to inform Al-Qaeda when the bomb was ready. In 2003, Trabelsi was sentenced to 10 years by a Belgian court for his plot to blow up the NATO base. What follows are excerpts from the interrogation of a Canadian Al-Qaeda recruit, Mohamed Mansour Jabara, by Canada's Security Intelligence Service in 2002. Jabara was to attack the U.S. and Israeli embassies in the Philippines in late 2001. Similar targets were cased in Singapore. This plot was ultimately disrupted after documents and videos relating to the Singapore operation were found in Afghanistan during U.S. military operations. Jabara fled to Thailand, Qatar, and then Oman. He was arrested there in March 2002 and was delivered to Canadian and then U.S. authorities, with whom he has cooperated. Jabara met with OBL, bin Laden, circa July 2001, in an effort to convince OBL of his potential as an AQ, Al-Qaeda operative, by highlighting his excellent English skills, his clean Canadian passport, and his high standing in his AQ training courses. OBL was apparently impressed and told Jabara to meet with Mohammed the Pakistani, MP, who would give Jabara instructions and funds for an operation. Mohammed the Pakistani was identified by the source as Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the 9/11 operational commander. MP provided advice and lessons on how to handle life in the city and how to prepare himself for AQ missions. This was necessary as he would need to be reacquainted with life outside Afghanistan. MP told Jabara that Jabara's job would be to provide money for a suicide operation in the Philippines. Jabara would be the go-between for the local SE, Southeast Asian operatives, and AQ. Jabara was not asked to be a driver or a suicide bomber for an operation, as there were hundreds of others in Afghanistan eagerly ready to fill that role. He was considered a more valuable entity given his abilities, language capability, and his clean Canadian passport. After 1 week, Jabara met a Malaysian man named Hambali at Hambali's apartment in Karachi. Hambali began giving details regarding the planned operations in the Philippines, including targets such as the American and Israeli embassies. Next day, MP told Jabara to make sure you leave before Tuesday, meaning that Jabara had to ensure that he left Pakistan by September 11, 2001. According to the source, Jabara understood this meant a big operation would happen on 11 September 2001, though he did not know where or what this would entail. The source advised that Jabara now believes MP was one of the masterminds behind the 9/11 attack. MP gave Jabara $10,000 for expenses. Jabara left for Hong Kong on 10 September 2001 and stayed there for 3 days. When Jabara was in the hotel in Hong Kong, he began to question whether or not he could really handle the task at hand. He felt, however, that as OBL had personally chosen him out of all the men in Afghanistan, he simply couldn't refuse the operation. In the end, Jabara decided to go ahead with the plans. Information derived from Mohammed Mansour Jabara, U.S. Department of Justice, Federal Bureau of Investigation, August 21, 2002. Jabara stated that there were code words used by al-Qaeda. The code words were generally established by the individual cells. Some of the code words they used in Asia were Merkel for Malaysia, soup for Singapore, terminal for Indonesia, hotel for Philippines, book for passport, American for white meat. Feroz Ali Abbasi is a Ugandan Briton who was captured in Pakistan after the fall of the Taliban. He had trained at an al-Qaeda camp in Afghanistan during 2000 and 2001, imprisoned at Guantanamo Bay, and released in 2005. Abbasi wrote a 146-page prison memoir explaining how he was sounded out for an operation against the United States in the period before 9/11, not by bin Laden, but by his key aides, Abu Hafs and Saif Adel. They were interested in Abbasi because of a mistaken assumption that because he came from Britain, he had a non-Muslim name that would allow him to travel in the West without attracting attention. Abu Hafs and Saif al-Adel were present in the room, the second and third highest in the command of al-Qaeda. The interview went as follows. Abu Hafs, what is your real name? Abbasi, why do you want to know that? Abu Hafs, do not worry, everything you say here is confidential. What is your name? Abbasi, Feroz Ali Abbasi. Abu Hafs, where are you from? Abbasi, I'm from Uganda. Abu Hafs. It was at this point that he pushed his turban off his head slightly and scratched. Would you like to take any actions against the Americans and the Jews? Abbasi. I replied, yes, I would like to take action against the American and Israeli forces because jihad is an obligation on my person. Abu Hafs. Do you know of any involvement of the Jews in Uganda's affairs? Abbasi. This question threw me right off. No. Abu Hafs, okay, we'll see about getting you some special training. They had made the assumption that I had a Christian name. I think I'm also right to speculate that Abu Hafs was actually looking for this as a most important condition to whatever he was devising. I did not get to hear about the scheme from Abu Hafs because they could not let me be party to such secrets if I could not be part of them. My name is wholly Islamic. And I think Abu Hafs had been thrown off when he had asked me what my name was, expecting a Christian name. According to the U.S. government, Feroz Abbasi heard bin Laden speak several times in al-Qaeda training camps. However, Abbasi did not have a personal audience with bin Laden, so for him, al-Qaeda's leader emerges as a somewhat remote figure in his memoirs. As far as Abbasi was concerned, Abu Hafs was the brains behind al-Qaeda. Osama bin Laden was just there for show. Others with limited contact with al-Qaeda's leader were more impressed. Mohammed Abdullah Warsame is a legal permanent U.S. resident and Canadian citizen who attended al-Qaeda training camps in Afghanistan in 2000. The following is from the affidavit the FBI filed before a grand jury hearing his case in 2005. By the defendant's admission, in or about early 2000, he became interested in the utopian Muslim society that had been created in Afghanistan. Warsame maintained to the interviewing agents that he had not intended to travel to Afghanistan to attend a training camp, but admitted that soon after arriving in Kabul, Afghanistan, he in fact did attend an al-Qaeda training camp. When asked how he knew that bin Laden was the emir of the camp, the defendant stated that he saw him on several occasions, that he attended lectures given by bin Laden, and that Warsame, the defendant, sat next to bin Laden on the floor at a meal. The defendant stated that bin Laden was very inspirational. A jihadist recruit with a somewhat remote view of bin Laden was John Walker Lind, the American Taliban. Lind was born in Washington, D.C. in February 1981, where he spent his childhood before his family moved to Marin County, California. When he was 16, he converted to Islam, which ultimately led him to travel to Yemen to study Arabic and then to Pakistan. In June 2001, he joined the Taliban and trained at the Al-Qaeda training camp Al-Farouk for 7 weeks, where he met bin Laden. Lind was part of a Taliban force seized by the Northern Alliance in late November 2001, following the 9/11 attacks and the start of U.S. military operations. Below are excerpts from FBI reports of its interviews with Lind in early December 2001. In these reports, Lind recalls meeting Osama bin Laden and training in Afghanistan. FBI report, interview of John Philip Walker Lind, December 9th, 10th, 2001. Lind advised that Osama bin Laden, UBL, visited the camp, Al-Farouk, on 3 to 5 occasions and was usually accompanied by one or two of his sons. Lind believes UBL's first visit was after having been in the camp for 3 weeks. UBL would give lectures on the local situation, political issues, old Afghan-Soviet battles, etc. Lind, along with 4 others, met UBL for approximately 5 minutes in a private setting. UBL made small talk and thanked them all for taking part in the jihad. Lind described UBL as being approximately 6'4", well-built, sits down a lot, drinks a lot of water, tires easily, sometimes stops talking and excuses himself, mild-mannered and a quiet speaker. UBL traveled in at least 2 Toyota Land Cruisers, believes white, in the company of at least 6 guards. Lind believes the guards looked like they were from Saudi Arabia or Yemen based on their features. Within the first several weeks of the training, early June 2001, Lind stated that he believes the camp's emir, Abdul Quddus, if not another instructor, told the trainees that UBL sent 50 people to carry out 20 Amniyat Istish Hadia, suicide operations. The talk amongst the group was that UBL had planned attacks against the U.S. and or Israel. Lind, along with approximately 20 other foreigners, Brits, Australians, Africans, Filipinos, were called one by one to a meeting with Abu Muhammad al-Misri, Egyptian, the general manager of all camps. Al-Misri asked Lind if he was interested in taking part in operations against the United States and Israel. Lind advised he declined and told al-Misri that he wanted to go to the front line and fight against the Northern Alliance. At some point during the training, Lind said he had been offered to swear allegiance to UBL/Al-Qaeda. Lind stated that he declined. However, he swore allegiance to jihad. While most of those in Al-Qaeda's training camps had limited personal interaction with bin Laden, some visitors, who claimed they were not affiliated with Al-Qaeda, were granted relatively easy access to him. Fuad al-Rabi'a is a Kuwaiti held in Guantanamo who is married with 4 children. Al-Rabi'a is, by his own account, a businessman and relief worker who was visiting Afghanistan in June of 2001, where he had a purely social visit with bin Laden. Al-Rabi'a says he was chosen by the Kuwaiti government to run the Peshawar office of an Islamic relief agency. Al-Rabi'a's testimony before a U.S. military tribunal in Guantanamo starts as he leaves Kuwait with a Muslim scholar named Abu Mulda, who believes that bin Laden might be the key to leading the way to the Mahdi, a savior figure in Islam, a person who is absolutely guided by God. As we were traveling from Kuwait, I realized the purpose of Abu Mulda's trip to Afghanistan differed from mine. I was there to see the refugees and to assist with their situation. Abu Mulda said there was a missionary man that told him there was a ruler, bin Laden. Abu Mulda said maybe bin Laden is al-Abu Asa, someone who will pave the way for the return of the Mahdi. Abu Mulda said he had to find out if this were true. If this were not true, the word had to get out to the people so they would not follow a false prophecy. I asked Abu Mulda how he was planning to see this person. I asked if we were going to climb mountains or go out in the middle of the night. Abu Mulda said no, and he was told that bin Laden is living inside a residence in Kandahar. Many people visit bin Laden there just like any normal person. Abu Mulda assured me we were not sneaking about to do anything illegal. I said, fine, I am going to Afghanistan for my purpose. To us in Kuwait before this, bin Laden was an eccentric millionaire who became a revolutionary. This was way before September 11th happened, and way before we realized what bin Laden was capable of doing. Bin Laden's house was in Kandahar, and everything looked peaceful there. We went inside. There were no guards, and we were not searched. Bin Laden was sitting in an open room, and he greeted us. We sat down. Abu Mulda talked, and I listened. Abu Mulda asked this person, bin Laden, where he was from, so on and so on. Then Abu Mulda asked bin Laden his opinion about killing civilians. I think Abu Mulda was referring to the bombing in Africa of the two U.S. embassies in 1998. Bin Laden replied he did not order the bombing, but he was not shocked by it. Bin Laden cited words from Arabic stating, I do not order massacres, but I do not object if I see them. So this did not sit well with Abu Mulda. Al-Abu Asa is not supposed to be killing people. He was supposed to be preaching to them and guiding them to the Mahdi. The conversation ended about late afternoon. A young man named Abu Suleiman came and showed bin Laden the hand warmer that Al-Rabi'a had brought from Kuwait. Abu Suleiman said that in Kuwait the item was used as an incense burner, but it is actually a hand warmer. It could be useful for people in the mountains. Bin Laden looked at me and said, we would rather have 300 pairs of woolen underwear instead of hand warmers. Abu Mulda asked bin Laden straightforward what he wanted. Bin Laden said he wanted the Americans out of the Gulf. Then I asked, how about Kuwait? Last time we had Saddam enter Kuwait in 1990, before the first Gulf War, because there was no one there to protect us. Bin Laden said, look at the big picture, meaning it was okay for Saddam to enter Kuwait again. It is our custom if someone invites you to their home, then before you leave the town, you have to go back and say farewell. So we went back to the house, but bin Laden was not there. So Abu Mulda and I went into a room where a videotape was played of bin Laden's interviews with CNN, Al Jazeera, and other news agencies. Nafia Nouradine was born in Morocco in 1967. In 1991, he left Morocco for Afghanistan, where he founded the Moroccan Islamic Combat Group. Nouradine's negotiations with al-Qaeda's leaders are emblematic of the kinds of deals that they cut with smaller groups animated by a specific national grievance. At the beginning of 2001, I met with Osama bin Laden and Ayman Zawahiri. During the meeting, I made a speech on the concepts of Jamaa Islamiya Muqatila Maghrabiya, the Moroccan Islamic Combat Group. Then I talked about the targets and the principles of the group. I asked al-Qaeda's leader to support the group both materially and militarily. Osama bin Laden said that the group's members could have paramilitary training in al-Qaeda's camps, inviting me to contact Abu Hafs, al-Qaeda's military commander. 2 days after the meeting with bin Laden, we had a meeting with Abu Hafs. We were promised the assistance of al-Qaeda to train Mujahideen and the men of the Moroccan Islamic Combat Group, and were handed over the sum of $3,000 by way of support from al-Qaeda to the group. In September 2003, a tribunal in Morocco convicted Nouradine of criminal association for the preparation of attacks aimed at destabilizing the public order and fabrication of documents, and sentenced him to 20 years. Egyptian Mahmoud Abdelkader Es-Sayed, also known as Abu Saleh, was sentenced in absentia in Egypt for 10 years for his role in the 1997 killings of 58 foreign tourists in Luxor, Egypt. In the spring of 1998, Es-Sayed arrived in Rome and requested political asylum. In late 1998, he moved to Milan, where he set up a mosque and was put under surveillance by DIGOS, an anti-terrorist unit of the Italian police. On July 10, 2001, Italian law enforcement raided Es-Sayed's apartment. He was not captured, having already fled Italy, where a letter was found dated May 14, 2001, with instructions for how militants could reach Kandahar, Afghanistan. On December 31st, 2001, the Arabic daily Al-Hayat confirmed that Es-Sayed had been killed in Afghanistan. What follows are edited transcripts of tape recordings made before the 9/11 attacks by Italian law enforcement of Es-Sayed's discussions with his circle of like-minded jihadists. It is illustrative of a strong, almost mystical desire amongst jihadists to travel to meet bin Laden. Conversation intercepted December 7th, 2000, at 12:04 p.m., with a microphone planted in a Citroën ZX-16V, a car with the number plate 4G9887, registered and used by Es-Sayed. Abu Saleh is Mahmoud Abdelkader Es-Sayed, an Egyptian militant who forged documents for Al-Qaeda. Nabil is Ben Atiya Nabil, a Tunisian. Adel is Ben Sultan Adel, a Tunisian. Nabil. Today we've seen a sensational thing. I've seen 4 decapitated heads of Russians. Probably a reference to videotapes widely circulated in militant circles featuring jihadists fighting the Russians in Chechnya. Abu Saleh. What, decapitated or cut? Nabil. Cut. They laugh. As goats. It's a party. Adel. Sheikh, if one wants to go and fight, why you don't let him go? Abu Saleh. The important thing is that you dream of it. It's to cultivate your faith. When the moment arrives, you'll never know if you will be a martyr here, in Algeria, in Tunisia, in America, or in Central Asia. Adel. I want to eliminate those pigs. Those swine, I hate them. It's necessary to leave. If only I could see the emir. Abu Saleh. What emir? Adel. The emir Abdallah. Osama bin Laden. Abu Saleh. There's a long way to go, but take it into your head that all the paths are dangerous. Adel. I'm ready to take them. It's better than staying here in Milan. Abu Saleh. You don't understand. To see the emir, you've many ways to ride and many groups to pass. As for my past experience, before getting a meeting with him, I had to swear with different groups. I was transferred in different training camps. Nabil, what was your impression? Abu Saleh, it's a sensation. I can't explain. Pray with me. Adel, this is what we ask, Sheikh. Nabil, our places are in the mountains of Afghanistan, and every person wishes this. He who doesn't think this way is a donkey that doesn't understand anything, because this is the way one can ride to face God. The contents of the following conversation, 13 months before the 9/11 attacks, are important because of references to a plot aimed at attacking the U.S. using airplanes. Transcript of a conversation intercepted on August 12, 2000, hour 10:16 a.m., with a microphone planted in a Citroën ZX-16V, car with the number plate 4G9887. Registered and used by Es-Sayed. Abu Saleh is Mahmoud Abdelkader Es-Sayed, the Egyptian militant who forged documents for Al-Qaeda. Abdesalam is Ali Abdulrahman Abdulsalam, a Yemeni who entered Italy holding a diplomatic passport. Abu Saleh, how was your trip? Abdesalam, well, I'm studying airplanes. Abu Saleh, what? Abdesalam, I'm studying airplanes. Abu Saleh, airplanes of a Yemeni company or another? Abdesalam, I hope, if God will wish, to bring you a window or a piece of an airplane the next time we will be together. Abdesalam, but the surprise strike will come from the other country. Abu Saleh, yes. Abdesalam, this will be one of those strikes that will never be forgotten. Abu Saleh, yes. Abdesalam, it will wreak such a great havoc that they will never know how to put things in order. This is a terrifying thing. This is a thing that spreads from north to south, from east to west. The person who engineered this program is a madman from a mental hospital, a madman but a genius. He is obsessed with this program. He will leave all dumbfounded. We will marry the Americans, so they will study the faith and the Quran. Remember, in the future, listen to the news and remember these words. We can fight any power using airplanes. They can't even stop us with heavy arms. We have only to hit them in the dark, day and night. The important thing is to reach the goal. The danger is in the airports. Abu Saleh. Rain. Rain. Abdesalam. Yes. There are clouds in the sky. In international territory. In that country, the fire has been lit and is awaiting only the wind.